Hello, ahoy, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan, thank you for being there. If you've never heard us before, well, you've stumbled upon the smartest show in the history of the solar system. Who knew? How lucky are you? Every week, we look at all the science secrets that are lurking through the universe, sometimes in space, sometimes in jungles, other times underwater, and we cover all that this week. You can hear about the future of robots. Seriously, how tiny ones could soon swim through your blood to save your life. We'll talk about that with the genius Onshan Pak.
So these robots are very small, so there is like thickness of your size of your hair. So it turns out that when you want to have this robot to swim in such a small scale, so the way that they need to swim is very different from how we swim. So the idea is, how can we use a computer algorithm to teach them how to swim by itself without us telling them how to swim?
And you can hear another brilliant episode of Amy's Aviation, learning about everything to do with planes. This week, it's about what actually powers them.
This means that the jet engine and the plane it's attached to are off. All that air that the engine needs is sucked in by a giant fan at the front of the engine.
And I've got your questions as always. This week, trying to figure out how carbon is made and how deep do tree roots go. It's on the way in a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. We start every show in the same way, looking at what science has been in your news this week. The James Webb Space Telescope, it's back again. We love hearing about it, that massive telescope looking at the oldest parts of the universe. It's taken a picture of the pillars of creation. It's a phenomenon that shows stars being made. In the picture, you'll see beams of almost cloudy light that shoot upwards like two towers. And the picture was taken of things 6,500 light years away. Also, space probes have found a big crater being made on Mars. It threw rocks and ground 19 miles away. It's made a 150-meter wide bowl. And it's kind of been made by something the size of a truck colliding with the red planet and making its mark. How amazing is it? We're doing things in the universe, sending rovers to Mars, and they are catching space history as it is being made. It'll leave us much better prepared for what could happen here on Earth one day. And finally, the Woodland Trust is urging you not to dump your pumpkins. We're a little after Halloween now, but if you do have some lying around, the Woodland Trust charity says they can be very harmful to hedgehogs. Many people think that putting pumpkins in the woods is a good idea because they turn to compost and can help trees. But the charity actually says they're quite toxic if hedgehogs eat them and instead could be used as bird feeders or donated to farms as animal feed. What a brilliant idea, making an old pumpkin into a bird feed, encouraging more wildlife in the ecosystem of your garden. That's fantastic. Let's catch up with Professor Hallocks now. Every week, we hear from loads of our favourite science geniuses on the show. For the last few weeks, we've been hearing Hallocks' Hydration Help Desk. It's a series talking about how water can be really good for you and why you need to drink lots of it. This is the last episode of this series, and he's talking all about making water. There's a lot of different ways to make drinking water, from condensation to desalination. New tech is helping us make it all the time, and Hallocks takes a look.
Hallocks' Hydration Help Desk. Call accepted.
Hello, Professor. I read that 1 in 10 people on Earth don't have access to clean drinking water. Why can't we just make more in a laboratory?
Ah, thought-provoking question there. Well, the short answer is we can make water. On cold days when the windows have misted up, we're doing it without even trying. The difficult part is making enough to provide a source of drinking water. Loads of scientists, though, are working on ways to make more drinkable water. Let's check it out. I've already mentioned mist on windows. That mist is made up of tiny drops of water which have condensed out of the air when they hit the cold glass. That's why it's called condensation. Condensation is water, and the process can be carried out on a bigger scale. Fog harvesters have been built in Ethiopia to catch the mist. They look like huge sheets of mesh, and the water droplets they trap are stored in tanks, literally making water from thin air. Of course, the oceans are full of water. You just can't drink it unless you take the salt out. That's a process called desalination. It's expensive and takes a very long time, but a new style of desalination plant has got everyone very excited. It's called the pipe and looks like a long, glittering silver, well, pipe. It's been developed off the coast of California, a very hot region in the United States, which suffers frequent droughts and will use solar power to create over 1.5 billion gallons of clean water every year. Just think, using the same technology could produce drinking water from seawater anywhere in the world. Nanobot, aren't we told that electronic objects and water are two things that don't go together? How does it all work?
Well, the tiny particles of salt in the water have a positive charge, and the molecules of water themselves have negative charges. A small electric current is sent through the water. Electric currents have a positive and negative aspect, and because opposites attract, the ions in the water are separated, enabling the salt to be removed.
Incredible. Given that 1 in 10 people across the world don't have access to clean running water, this technology could help millions across the world.
All right, let's do my favourite part of the show. It's where I find your questions. You normally send them to me as voice notes on the Free Fun Kids app, and then I do a lot of digging. I spend hours looking online and through books, just diving into science, trying to figure out the answer for you. I love it, and I love all the questions that you send as a voice note on the Free Fun Kids app. Just like this from Barney.
Hello, my name is Barney. I'm 6 years old, and I want to know, how is carbon made?
All right, Barney. Carbon is a very important element. It's found all over the world in air. It makes carbon dioxide, which plants breathe. It helps trap the sun's heat too. If there was no carbon, none of the plants could breathe, which means you would struggle to breathe and eat too. And all of the oceans would be frozen solid. Have a listen to this. Mind-blowing. Where carbon comes from. Carbon, a lot of it was made in stars. So the nearest one to us is the sun. There's a process called nuclear fusion happening all the time on the sun. There's a lot of pressure involved and heat. It turns one element, one gas, into another. And at the start of the universe, that made loads of carbon, which found its way here to Earth. So when you're breathing in air, when you are eating plants, you're actually taking something in that has been around since the very start of the universe. Barney, thank you for that question. You can also leave questions as a review on Apple Podcasts, like Luke in Brighton, who wants to know, how deep do tree roots go? Well, normally, Luke, tree roots go between 1 and 2 meters deep into the ground. Almost all of the roots are quite high up. They're found close to the top of the soil in the top half. Sometimes tree roots can grow deep to about 5 meters. Sometimes they can grow even deeper, down to 10 meters. But the shepherd tree in the Kalahari Desert, which is in Africa, the roots there can grow down to 70 meters, sprawling underground to keep the massive trees sturdy and upright. So Luke, that's how deep tree roots can go. Up to 70 metres down in the ground. Thank you so much for your question. If you've got something that you want answered next week on the podcast, dead easy, get out of the Free Fun Kids app, click record a message and send it through to me as a voice note. I cannot wait to hear what you want to ask. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, big news this week. Scientists have taught robots how to swim. Let's find out more with Onshan Pak, who's from the University of Santa Clara. Onshan, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
First off, why teach these small robots how to swim? What gave you that idea?
Yeah, so there are many applications of these, you know, micro robots, right? For example, so these robots are very small, so there is like thickness of your size of your hair. So it turns out that when you want to have this robot to swim in such a small scale, so the way that they need to swim is very different from how we swim. So the idea is, how can we use a computer algorithm to teach them how to swim by itself without us telling them how to swim? So, and there are many applications. If we can make this work, we can have this micro robots to deliver drugs in our body, to perform surgery for us inside our body. So there are a lot of applications of these micro robots. Yeah.
These small robots, you say, they are no bigger than our hair. What are they made of then? There can't be that much inside the robots if they're so small.
Yeah, that's a great question. So because they're so small, so we cannot really afford a lot of complicated design. So we have nanotechnology to make these tiny robots, right? So some of them are made of nanowires. So nanowires is some materials, metallic materials, right, that we can make them very, very small. So making them small is not a problem, but how to design simple mechanisms to help them swim is the challenge that we're encountering here. And that's why we're integrating the advancement of machine learning or artificial intelligence to make this work.
So tell us more about that. When you wanted these micro robots, to learn how to swim, how did you start? What were you trying to get the computer to teach them?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a little bit like putting a human baby into a swimming pool without teaching the baby how to swim at all, right? So initially the baby will struggle, right? But then the baby will try some actions, right? Moving his or her arms, right? The legs. And then the baby will start to gain some experience, right? And from that experience, when I move my left arm, I will actually go forward. When I push my legs, it will actually go backward, for example. So this is kind of learning from experience. So it's actually very similar. Now we are not putting a baby, but putting a swimmer into a computer algorithm, right, to simulate the environment in the very, very small scale. So the robots will try different things and they will gain experience. And then from the experience, they will know whether the action that they took is actually a good action or bad action. So this is what they call reinforcement learning. So from the experience, they progressively learn what are the best strategy to swim. It's actually very much like human learning, but now all by a computer on its own. Sorry.
When these microrobots are hopefully in our bloodstream to deliver medicine, how much will they be able to do? Are you just kind of programming them to do one thing and you're keeping their fingers crossed that they'll be able to do it? Or are they making decisions along the way when maybe they hit obstacles or come into difficulties?
Oh, that's a really great question. So now we are doing the very first step, which is to help them, to have them teach themselves how to swim. So they interact with the environment and then they try to learn what is out there and then try to perform the actions. But this is only the very first step, right? Learning how to swim. And then we do the second step, which is how do they navigate from one point to the other point, right? So they not only need to know how to swim, they also need to know how to turn, for example, right? When you want to turn around, they need to do other actions rather than just swimming straight, right? So this is the swimming and the navigation part. But when you want to deliver drugs to different parts of our body, you know, you don't just need to know how to swim. You may also need to know how to crawl on surfaces like intestines, for example. So now they will need to adjust, you know, their movements from swimming to crawling, right? And sometimes they may need to jump around obstacles, as you said, right? So it's pretty much like a triathlon. So that is the next step we try to do. Now we're just doing swimming, but later on we need to make it more like a triathlon that can adjust their movements around the body so they can really do the drug delivery or microsurgeries that we are envisioning.
You say they need to crawl, they need to swim. What actually is powering the robot? I mean, they can't have arms and legs, surely.
Great. So there are many ways to power this. So right now, so sometimes people use external magnetic field. So this micro robot, some of them are made of magnetic components. So we will actuate or make them move by adjusting the external magnetic field so that they can move their arms, but their different components, mechanical components, based on their response to the external magnetic field, using magnets, basically.
Now, this is happening at the moment. the way AI and robots change grows year on year on year on year. What are you looking forward to see robots be able to do in kind of 5 or 10 years' time?
So there's a lot of opportunities in this field, right? As we mentioned, you know, right now we're really just doing the first step, you know, having them to swim in. But later on, as I said, we need to have them crawl, have them jump around obstacles. We also want them to be able to actually detect, some chemical signals. For example, they want to get to somewhere. We don't know, let's say, where the cancer cell is. If we're able to actually have them find what they need to find and then go there by themselves autonomously, that will be a great help to the, that will be an evolution of the medical treatment of many diseases. So that will be, you know, far-reaching goal we're trying to get.
And you know when you see sci-fi movies when the robots take over and there are always people in like white lab coats and they're always panicked and it's kind of like they've pushed it too hard, I guess, are you ever worried that that might be you?
Yeah. And I, this is interesting. I keep thinking about this myself as well. Yeah. But sometimes I think that, you know, even things that are not as smart as this kind of smart robots that human make, they can all make mistakes as well, right? So even a car that we design, right, that can also turn out to be a disaster if we don't use them properly. Yeah. So whether they have artificial intelligence or, you know, without artificial intelligence, I think humans just need to be responsible and then, you know, design the machines, the robot, you know, in a good manner that they won't harm us in the future. So,
well, it's been a real treat to chat to you all the way from California, early in the morning for you. So I really appreciate you taking the time. Onshan Pak, thank you for being there.
No problem. Thank you. Thanks for talking with me.
Let's do this week's Dangerous Dan then, where we look at the most mean and strangely cruel things in the universe. This time out, we're looking at an incredible predator that I've only just learned about. To find out more, we need to head to Madagascar. Madagascar is an island off the coast of Africa. You might know it from the movies. It's home to the lemur, famously. And there's also one creature you might not have heard about, the fossa. Now, why I love doing this podcast with you, it's just learning about so many incredible beasts that we never talk about. The fossa normally has a golden sandy coat. It's got wide searching eyes, small open ears. They look a bit like a small panther, but are more closely related to the mongoose. And it looks like a big cat, but kind of closer to the mongoose. It's the largest of all the carnivores on Madagascar. And they're the oldest too. They've been around for years and years and years. They eat lemurs and birds and rodents and lizards. They go hunting through the day, in the morning and in the evening. If you've got a cat, they're a bit like that too. They kind of sleep on and off throughout the day. It's got sharp, strong teeth, razor-like claws as well that can swipe, and it's a very smart beast, incredibly agile, climbing trees to perch and search for food. Now, they can be quite heavy for their size, but what's brilliant, the fossa is amazingly quick, supple and flexible, and if it wants its dinner, it's remarkably deadly, which means the fossa from Madagascar needs to go on our Dangerous Dan list. Okay, last up this week, let's get another episode from Amy's Aviation. Earlier, we heard from Hallux. We're always hearing from genius friends of the show. Amy loves aeroplanes and loves talking about why they fly, what the wings are made of. We've heard about what the propellers do. This week on Amy's Aviation, it's all about jet engines and how they power planes to keep them in the sky.
We've been making some more paper planes in class. Now, they're not bad, but even my best ones don't stay up very long. What my plane really needs is more thrust. You see, if you want your aircraft to fly, it needs lift to get it into the air. But it's thrust that keeps it going once it's up there. Some aircraft use propellers to create thrust, using the movement of air over the propeller blades. But there's another, more powerful way to do the job. Planes in the sky. Phew! There's some clever science behind the power of jet engines, and it all starts in the 18th century. Now, obviously, you didn't get many planes in the 18th century. Okay, you didn't get any planes, but there's a very good reason why we're here. There was a famous scientist who came up with the idea that's behind all jet engines.
My third law of motion states that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. I thank you.
Isaac Newton. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So what's that all about? Think of it this way. Have you ever let go of a balloon before the end's been tied? What happens? That's right. Air comes out of the balloon, doesn't it? That's what makes the rude sound. And as it does, the balloon's propelled all around the room in all sorts of crazy directions. Well, that's Newton's equal and opposite reactions at work. A jet engine is like a tube in which fuel and air are burned under very high pressure. It gets so amazingly hot that it forces gases out of the back of the tube. This pushes the plane forward. This means that the jet engine and the plane it's attached to are off. All that air that the engine needs is sucked in by a giant fan at the front of the engine.
3, 2, 1.
If you want to take a trip around the moon, propellers and jet engines wouldn't be any use because there isn't any air up in space. You'd need to take your own air in tanks to mix with the fuel. This sort of engine is called a rocket.
And we have
liftoff. Now, whilst Newton could take credit for the scientific principle behind jets, someone else had to actually build the first one. Although, it was really two people. Meet Dr. Hans von Oheim, a German who designed a turbojet in Germany just before the Second World War. What he didn't know was that the British were working on something very similar. Now, while Sir Frank Whittle registered a patent for his turbojet before Hans did, Hans beat Sir Frank to the skies, with his plane taking flight in 1939. It wasn't until 1941 before the British jet was airborne. So who can take the credit? These days, both designers are recognised as being the co-inventors of the jet engine, even though both worked separately and knew nothing of the other's work. You'll find jet engines on almost all types of aircraft, and there's one thing they have in common. They're fast! We use the speed of sound as a measuring stick for airplane velocity. Sound moves through air at about 760 miles an hour, and if an airplane reaches the speed of sound, its speed is called Mach 1. Now, if an airplane reaches double the speed of sound, its speed is Mach 2, which would mean travelling over 1,500 miles an hour. And if you think that's fast, well, it gets even faster than that. Some jets can reach Mach 3 or even more, while space rockets can get up to Mach 10 and beyond. It's just a shame I can't build a rocket for my paper plane. Time for me to fly. See you soon and chucks away.
We'll have more from Amy's Aviation at the same time next week. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. If you've got a question that you want answered on the show, the best way to get through to me, which makes you star in the podcast as well, just leave it as a voice note on the free Fun Kids app. Dead simple. If you've enjoyed some of the series that we've had so far, we heard from Professor Hallocks, we heard from Amy's Aviation. We've got so many of them over on Apple, Google, Spotify, wherever you get your shows. They're on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com too. Fun Kids as well, we are a children's radio station. I'd love you to listen across the country on your DAB digital radio, on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com.